You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. A few weeks ago, we hosted a program on the cultural milieu around the writer and thinker Aldous Huxley, who lived not far from here in the Hollywood Hills. And in one of those iconic photos of Laura and Aldous Huxley, where they're reclining on this wonderful chaise in their backyard, we can see the Hollywood sign looming in the backyard. So I kind of like to think of it that tonight the Hollywood sign is moving into the foreground as we welcome author Leo Brody, who is one of America's leading cultural historians and film critics. It's fun to read Leo's work wherever it appears, and he wrote a recent essay on Christian Marclay's installation, The Clock, which is at LACMA. If you haven't seen it, do. It's fantastic. The Clock is a mashup of thousands of film images, and Brody writes, "As it ticks away, the clock taps into the enormous storehouse of images bouncing around in our head. Do we remember, however dimly, who we were when we first saw those images?" So many film images living in our head. And it made me think about my early sightings of the Hollywood sign as a 14-year-old driving across town from Culver City to my aunt's house and the Hollywood sign looming on the hill, or climbing up that hill and getting stuck in Poison Oak. These are very iconic memories. Brody understands the role of film in our memories, in our sense of self-knowledge, and likewise in his newest book, The Hollywood Sign, he probes the history and the metaphysical life of an advertisement which has come to symbolize the dreams and fantasies of millions. His most recent book, From Chivalry to Terrorism, was named Best of the Best by the Los Angeles Times. Among his previous books, The Frenzy of Renown, Fame and Its History was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. He is currently university professor and Leo S. Bing Chair in English and American Literature at USC. And we are so honored that Leo could be joined tonight by Kevin Roderick as an interlocutor. Kevin is a journalist, editor, blogger, and author who lives here in LA. And I know many of you begin your days by opening your browser to the wonderful blog LA Observed, the widely cited news website that Forbes rated as best of the web, which Kevin Roderick founded and edits. He's a contributing writer on politics and media at Los Angeles Magazine, an award-winning commentator and director of the UCLA newsroom at UCLA. He is the author most recently of Wilshire Boulevard, or as my grandmother would say, Wilshire Boulevard, Grand Concourse of Los Angeles. So I kind of think of tonight as the Miracle Mile and the Hollywood sign in dialogue. Please welcome Leo Brody. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you, Louise. If we can have the first image, great. This book comes at the Hollywood sign from a variety of perspectives. I mean, Hollywood is a place. We all know it as a place. It's a geographic place, but it's also a business. It's a vision. It's an ideal site of dreams of fame and fortune. And part of the paradox of how the Hollywood sign got to be so significant in this way is how did it get to be what symbolizes the synecdoche for all of that, some kind of overarching umbrella here. What happened? Where did it start? I mean, the first chapter in my book, I wanted to get to what's the beginnings of Hollywood, Hollywood before the sign. What was Hollywood like as a place? So here is, let me just get my little pointer out and things. This is the first plat map of Hollywood, H.H. Wilcox and Company, 1887. The Wilcoxes came out from the Midwest. He was a real estate developer there. He'd started in New York, came to the Midwest, married his wife, Dayida Wilcox, who survived him in Hollywood and became the kind of doyen of early Hollywood there. And this was at a time, the 1880s, when the first link between Chicago and Los Angeles, the first railroad link, came into being. So it was the beginning of one of the first of the real boom times, the real estate boom times of Hollywood. The Wilcoxes lived in Los Angeles and used to take a buggy ride out to this area, fell in love with it. Harvey Wilcox bought it and laid out this. Now, so this is the earliest Hollywood here. It's 120 acres. It's maybe 24 square blocks or so. It looks pretty grand, big hotels and things like that, in a kind of idealized way, in that kind of grandiose way that we're all familiar with from films, you know, started early on in terms of real estate development in Hollywood. Also in the 1880s, the Chamber of Commerce was founded, 1888. So 1887, Hollywood, 1888, Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce. The idea of boosterism, the idea of Los Angeles as the place to be, came. This was sort of in the wake, let's say, of the gold rush. The gold rush to California was for something substantial, for gold. This gold rush was for land. It was for health. It was for a variety of reasons. And it would come to be, of course, with the under the kind of umbrella of the Hollywood sign, a rush to a kind of self-enhancement on all levels there. So what was early Hollywood like? Here's a brochure, cover of a brochure from early Hollywood there. And you can see the you know, what it looks like. That's cut off at the bottom there. But it says, noted for its many beautiful homes, fine paved streets, and pleasant drives, some beautiful neighborhoods there. This was the lure of Hollywood. What did Hollywood want to do? What did early Hollywood want to do? It wanted to compete with Los Angeles. It wanted to compete with Pasadena. It wanted to have gardens. It wanted to have parades. It wanted to have rich people, for the most part. Rich people with fancy mansions. To the extent that there were any rooming houses, very few in early Hollywood, they tended to have signs that said, no Jews, dogs, or actors allowed. So it was a little bit exclusionary. And another part of that exclusionary side of early Hollywood was that it was prohibitionist. The Wilcoxes were temperances. So it was a kind of prohibitionist, kind of temperance utopia for very rich white Christian people that would keep out, in a sense, in a very definite way, keep out the kind of people who were living in Los Angeles, of all places, are starting to come into Los Angeles. This was an escape from Los Angeles. What did it have to do with the movies? Not very much. Not very much at all. Just think about the early movies. Where were the movies? Triangle, let's say. One of the early great companies, Triangle, made up of Max Sennett, D.W. Griffith, and Thomas Ince. Thomas Ince shot his westerns in Santa Monica. Max Sennett was in Edendale, and Griffith was downtown. The early Triangle itself actually started in Culver City, and became then where MGM was. And MGM always been in Culver City as well. So the idea that Hollywood was a place that had anything to do, particularly with the movies, took a long time in developing. There's an article in the Los Angeles Times about 1915 or so that talks about the title is something like Where Movies Are Hatched, the capital city of movie land. What are they talking about? Universal in the San Fernando Valley. The word Hollywood does not appear, 1914, 1915. The first real studio, I mean, there's some early studios that are there for a little bit. Warner's is there for a little bit and then moves. Bison, you know, various of the early production companies now since vanished. But a lot of them, again, are far away. Zelig is over there in Lincoln Park. Again, everybody is on the periphery. Why should they want to be in Hollywood? Why should they want to be in this place that in 1903 becomes a small municipality, and immediately starts outlawing things, nothing smelly, nothing loud, of course no liquor, no bars, things like that. This is part of the DNA of Hollywood, but a very submerged DNA. And the only studio that's really set up in Hollywood is Chaplin's, still there on La Brea. Now the home of the Muppet, Jim Henson's. I'm sure you've seen the picture of Kermit the Frog dressed as Charlie Chaplin that's above the doorway there. Chaplin managed to have this studio after a large fight there. Hollywood City Council did not want this studio there to a great extent, but they were persuaded by the bankers because by 1915, 16, 17, 18, when Chaplin's studio went up there, they saw that money was involved. But they still didn't want it to look like a movie studio, and that's why when you see it today, it looks as it did originally. It looks like a small English village on La Brea there. They didn't want it to look like a studio, and they also, because they didn't want it to somehow lure the students from Hollywood High, not too far away, you know, into the den of iniquity. Well, what did some of these places look like in early Hollywood? Here's one of them. This is the house of Paul de Longpre, who was a French artist who was lured by Deida Wilcox. He had moved to Los Angeles after coming to New York after a bank failure in France, made a reputation for himself. He was a painter of flowers, basically, but made a reputation for himself in New York, then somehow had some health problems, came out to Los Angeles, and was lured into Hollywood with free land from her, because she thought this would be upper class, that, again, was part of the image of Hollywood. And he had famous gardens. One of the things that he had to do in recompense for having this land from Deida Wilcox was to allow his gardens to be seen by truckloads, wagon-drawn, horse-drawn truckloads, of tourists coming out to look at it. So already this kind of sense of tourism in Hollywood is very much, again, part of that DNA. This is, as I said, it's de Longpre's house. It was at the corner of Prospect and Cahuenga. Prospect is the street that became Hollywood Boulevard. So if you can think of Prospect and Cahuenga in your head and think that this is what used to be there, it's a real act of the imagination. Now, here is another house here. This is the Castle Glengarry. This was built by a doctor named Schlosser, who changed his name in during World War I from Schlosser to Castles, because he didn't want to be thought of as pro-German there. He built this one, and then he sold it, and then across the street he built this one. There are two. This is like 1912 up to 1914 or so. And these were at the corner of Franklin and Argyle. So if you think of Franklin and Argyle today, and I actually went out and took a picture of it, there's Franklin and Argyle today, if you can think of those places. And actually, if you look up at the top there, this apartment house is called Castle Argyle. It's sort of like some dim remembrance of Dr. Castle here in this otherwise neighborhood. And if you know anything about, you know, the later history of Hollywood, this is the motel where Janis Joplin died, over there. So, I mean, this is part of my image of Hollywood. I think part of all of our images, this kind of incredible palimpsest of time and space and overlays, thinking about the past in all these different ways there. De Longpre, by the way, when the name of Prospect was being changed, they wanted to call it De Longpre because he was the most famous resident of Hollywood. But he finally demurred. He wrote a nice letter to the newspaper saying, no, it should be called Hollywood Boulevard, which, of course, it is today, except for that little piece past Vermont at the other end, which is still called Prospect. And of course, the Longpre got that very narrow little street there near Fountain. Let me go back just slightly to that one. This is a significant place because this is really the gateway for Chaplin to get into Hollywood to a certain extent there. This is Dr. Schlosser is the first person to really allow the movie business to shoot there. Otherwise, they were stealing shots of various mansions. And so the first full-length comedy, Tilly's Punctured Romance with Chaplin, Mabel Normand, and Marie Dressler, was shot in and around, a lot of it was shot in and around this place there. And there's pictures of Dr. Schlosser with some of the stars there holding hands there. So that's a kind of, you know, somehow the old facade, let's say, the old facade of Hollywood was being cracked in some way, and the movie business was coming in, although it was still not so much the studios and not so much the people who live there at all. It was still trying to be a kind of somewhat fancy place. I show this one because it's, people don't, another one of these kind of layered things that not everybody's aware of. This is a house that was at the corner of Yucca and Cherokee, sort of if you go past the parking lot of Musso and Frank's and go up a little bit, that's where this was. And this is a house that was called Oscott because L. Frank Baum lived in this house and wrote all the Oz books in this house except the first. So now, why is he living here? Well, he used to go down to Del Coronado. He and his family used to go there for the summer. In 1912, he came up to to Hollywood. He tried to be interested in the movie business, but didn't do so well. But another intriguing thing, and this is sort of as part of the context of kind of the utopias of Hollywood and Hollywoodland, both Baum and his wife were theosophists. Because his mother-in-law was a great feminist and theosophist from Chicago there and influenced them tremendously. And not very far from this, on the western side of Beechwood Canyon, was a whole theosophist community here, which is still there, actually. I mean, of course, the hills are filled in, and you can't get such a clear picture of it. This is the Temple of the Rosy Cross there, which is on Vista del Mar. If you've ever been up there, the Crotona community, and they're all sprinkled all around there, among the bungalows and other styles of houses, are the houses, often you can see a dome on them, houses of the Theosophist followers there. Now, whether Baum came to this place because it was connected to Theosophy or not, it's very hard to pin down, but it's only a few blocks away and in the neighborhood. So here's the question. Here's one of the questions. How did Hollywood get to be the word that was used for everything having to do with the movie business? By the early 1920s, you have two competing narratives about Los Angeles there. One is this booster narrative that I've been talking about that's fueled by real estate development and very much pushed by the Los Angeles Times. 1921, LA Times story in March, headline, slogan tells gospel truth. What's the slogan? What's the gospel? The United States Chamber of Commerce recently sent out a map, quote, showing the entire country black, except for a wide circle around the city, that is Los Angeles, and declaring that only in the white spot was business good. This was the best place here. And, of course, the kind of not very submerged racist side of this is apparent as well. This is another, it's an escape. It's a place to escape to. This is very much connected to a whole campaign, a boosterist campaign of the LA Times in the period that's very much connected in its turn to real estate development. It was called the Greater Southern California Straight Ahead campaign. And Los Angeles had already, even by the end of the 19th century, been considered the best self-promoting city in America. So much so that, let's say, the town council of Tombstone, Arizona, comes out to Los Angeles in the 1920s to find out clever ways to promote them. And this is, of course, when the gunfight at the OK Corral actually gets established. Gunfight at the OK Corral happened in the 1880s, or 1881, I think it is. But it's not until the 1920s, with this kind of impetus of what L.A. was doing and what Hollywood was doing, that they decided to make a big deal out of it. Again, in 1923, a little later, there's another headline that says, Los Angeles is officially declared America's finest place to live. And there's a big map, again, showing the ugly parts of America versus Los Angeles there. And the part of it that I like the best is right around San Francisco and Southern California, they've written in something that says, the hot, dry, electrified, charged wind causes nervous disturbances. So don't live in Northern California, please. So there's the boostery side. That's one of the narratives. But then there's another side that's coming up, and that's the scandalous side there. In the early 1920s, you have several scandals. You have the Fatty Arbuckle scandal, which takes place in San Francisco, but in fact is blamed on Hollywood. You have the murder of William Desmond Taylor, who had been a director, who had been the head of the Directors Guild, with which Mary Miles Minter and Mabel Normand were not implicated in it, but were somehow part of the whole story there. You have the death of Wallace Reed, a hunky early star there from drug addiction. You have the death of Olive Thomas, who's considered to be the first flapper, as the wife of Jack Pickford, Mary Pickford's brother. All these things are starting to happen. Scandal is becoming the definition of Hollywood there. And denounced in the pulpits all across America and boycotted by women's clubs and things like that. So you have these two kinds of images. Yes, let's go to Hollywood, it's great. Let's go to Los Angeles, it's great. Buy this land. And the other one is, but Hollywood is evil. So this is a poster from 1923 of a movie called Hollywood. And so the term is already being used in this kind of umbrella synecdoche way. There, it's actually a comedy there, but what, look at the image. Here is this big male head swallowing all these starlets there, or these young women who are coming there. Certainly a kind of malevolent images. One of the early directors called these young women in Hollywood there the posse of penniless pulchritude there, who were roaming the streets of Hollywood. So the place that the Wilcoxes had founded as a kind of escape from the evils of the city, in many eyes, was an image of the crime itself. So into this is 1923, and also in 1923, here we have come on the Hollywood sign. Hollywood land, you're the kind of publicity shot breaking the ground for Hollywood land. The sign is up there. The sign, as you may know, that was Harry Chandler, the publisher of the Times, wanted the sign. He said, well, I want the sign big enough to be read from Wilshire. Now, to be read from Wilshire, what did that mean? Well, one thing that it meant was to be read by somebody driving in a car. Cars were becoming more of a middle-class mode of transportation. These weren't the fancy rich cars of the earlier part of the century. And people would come out and drive around. Also, at this time, cars tended not to be sedans yet. They start to become more sedan-like, that is, enclosed in the early 1920s. They were open. So a tourist thing to do was to go from one development site to another. There's some precedent for the sign like this. There's a sign that says Whitley Heights. It's not as big, it's not as prominent for the development near Cahuenga there. But I think one of the interesting precedents for it, if you look at some of the early photographs, there's a big H on a hill farther to the west there, and that was for Hollywood High. Schools, high schools and colleges were starting to do that. I think it started in Berkeley. That, you know, put a big letter up on the hill to advertise themselves. So here's the Hollywood land. Here are a couple of starlets, probably lent by Max Sennett to publicize it, sitting there in a nice steam shovel. This is Hollywood land in 1924. There's a sign over here, still not very developed. Here's the Hollywood land Realty office, which is still there, as many of you may know, and here the gates have all been built. They're starting to build that little commercial area there, but it's still, you know, pretty rudimentary, pretty embryonic. But it's all starting here in 1923-24. Here is a advertisement of one of many advertisements that's in the Los Angeles Times for Hollywood land, and what does it say? It says, close to the center, the supreme achievement in community building, above the turmoil of the city. Once again, just as almost like a descendant from the Wilcoxes, once again, a sense that you wanted to escape from the city to Hollywood land. And look at the city here. The city is totally clogged, and it has all these clouds here. We know what those clouds mean. Actually, the word smog does not appear in print until the early 1940s, but they talk about the smoke and fog already at this point. So the portmanteau word has not yet been coined, but the idea is definitely there. And here's this young couple in their open roadster. They're getting away from the crowded city and of course, for the who are the people in the city as well. For your family's sake, investigate Hollywood. And a lot of other ones, there's a lot of, actually, in some of the other ads, there's a lot about the, you know, protect the lungs of your children and things like that, and get away. Come up into the hills there. This is the sign in those days. 40,000 light bulbs in it. It said Holly. It blinked. Hollywood land. Hollywood land. A fellow named Albert Cote lived in a shack behind it to replace the light bulbs behind the H. It was there, it was gaudy, it was flamboyant, but it was temporary. It was impermanent. It was not supposed to last. This is the brochure from 1926-27 or so for Hollywood land. And what I want to point out about this is that here is All these searchlights, Klieg lights, and things like that. And this is Hollywood, Hollywood's Great White Way there in comparison with the Broadway's Great White Way. Once again, I want to stress that the studios aren't there, the performers aren't there, but what is there is the theaters, the commerce. That's okay. The commerce of the movies is fine to be on Hollywood Boulevard. And Charles Toberman, who was one of the early developers who did the Egyptian theater along with Grauman, as well as the Chinese theater, and the Hollywood Roosevelt Hotel, and many, many other properties there, that was fine. That kind of uplift, that kind of lavishness, that grandiosity was fine. Not the movie business itself. And Toberman was very, after Chaplin's studio got in, he wanted to drop, close the door, pull up the ladder at that point, and said that they had to go, all the studios had to go down past Santa Monica Boulevard to the extent that they would be allowed in Hollywood at all there. If you look through this brochure, the main point of this brochure is that to show you that the vegetation grows up. It's sort of before and after of a lot of houses because people, I suppose, were worried that, in fact, it wouldn't grow so well. But there's not one person from the movie business depicted in this. You didn't want them there to sell to the kind of people that you wanted to sell to. Here's a young lady from the movie business. This is Peg Entwistle, who in 1932... her body is found below the Hollywood sign, supposedly a suicide. It's probably the most famous story about the sign, and I'm sure many of you have heard it before. How true is it? Hard to say. She was British. She grew up in Wales and then went to London, born in Wales, rather, and grew up in London. She was in a movie called 13 Women, which was released in September, and also her suicide was in that September. The usual story is that she committed suicide because she had failed in Hollywood. So it becomes a kind of little morality tale about the horrible lure of Hollywood and how it dashes the dreams of young people there. But what does her suicide note say? It says, "I'm afraid I'm a coward. I am sorry for everything. If I had done this a long time ago, it would have saved a lot of pain." Signed, P.E. The movie was made 3 months before, and it was released the same week that she committed suicide there. What happened a long time ago? I mean, it seems to be about something else, but somehow most of the stories, not all of them, I must say, there were a couple stories, a story in the Chicago Tribune, I think, that says because of a fateful love affair. But most of the stories say, this is Hollywood. This is what happens to people in Hollywood. It's also strange, I don't know, I mean, it's one of those mysteries. She lived just above, with her uncle, just above Franklin. So she had to walk all the way up to the sign to do this. She had to be very resolute in order to do this. And nobody had running shoes or things like that in those days. It's a very steep, there are no sidewalks. Remember, Hollywood Land was built for cars. It was not built for pedestrians there. How did she get up there? How did she keep that focus? I don't know. But just to give you a sense of that, this is actually, I took this from in front of her uncle's house, which is still there. So you can kind of just see how would you, just the distance of trying to get up there. And if any of you have, I'm sure some of you have been up there. I mean, the land, the hillsides are so steep and it's so hard to get a purchase in them with your shoes or your feet. It seems like it raises, the whole story raises a lot more questions than it answers. Well, here we are in the 1930s, though. Peg starting out in 32. This is from a movie called Hollywood Boulevard in 1936 there. And my point here is that at this point, this time in the history of the sign, it is not considered to be that significant. This is a montage at the beginning of the film, and it shows you the Chinese theater, it shows you the Brown Derby, and then a little shot of the Hollywood sign. I mean, in fact, if you're trying to think about what really symbolizes Hollywood during this period, it really is those two, the Chinese theater and the Brown Derby. They're the ones that pop up more often in imagery as emblems of Hollywood than the Hollywood sign does. 1939, they stopped maintenance on the Hollywood sign. And in 1949, the Parks and Recreation Department want to tear it down as a public menace. Whereupon the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce says, we'll take it over. Just knock the land off. So that's another significant moment in the history of the sign, because it's become Hollywood there. It's no longer connected to its real estate development roots in the same way. But it's deteriorating. It's falling apart. This is actually a shot from a film noir from 1953 called Down Three Dark Streets there, where the, you know, the climax occurs at the Hollywood sign. Broderick Crawford's the star, and he shoots it out with the criminal at the end there. And it's part, it's sort of like it's the deterioration of the sign, and it's the deterioration of Hollywood's image and Los Angeles's image of itself at this point. If you look at how is Los Angeles and Hollywood viewed in the 1930s, it's all about oranges and bathing beauties and things like that. By the 1950s, it's the gritty city. It's the film noir city. It's the dragnet city. This is the city there. It's a much darker place. Grit instead of glamour. Well, the Chamber of Commerce takes it over, and it's on the way. This is like the seed of its icon. You know, it's becoming an icon, but it hasn't happened yet. But so people are starting just a little bit. There's lots of patching that goes on. You know, every time it says, we're going to fix the sign, the H is knocked down for, you know, a year or a couple of years, and they put the H back up. It was built on telephone poles driven into the ground with white sheet metal. It's very thin. I mean, it was supposed to be impermanent. It wasn't supposed to last, and it wasn't lasting. Any wind that came along, you know, knocked a piece of it off in one. So it keeps getting patched and patched through the 50s and 60s and into the 70s. And then another intriguing thing happens. This is January 1st, 1976. Danny Feingood, who's a student in the public art class in Northridge at CSUN, Northridge, is given an assignment, do a public piece of art. And so what he does is he takes two pieces of white material and two pieces of black material, and he turns Hollywood into Hollyweed there. Since the legislature had just decriminalized marijuana, this was a very appropriate thing. I think this is a significant moment, because what Danny Feingood starts and what he sees in a way, and what artists like, let's say, Ed Ruscha, and Abner Biberman, people like that had seen already, is something about the iconic nature of the sign. I mean, the sign is weird as an American icon because it's a word. It's not the Statue of Liberty. It's not the Liberty Bell. You know, it's not Mount Rushmore. It's not something that represents something else. It doesn't have a human image to it. It's just a piece of language, a piece of sculpture, almost. And Danny Feingood, by this kind of manipulation, emphasizes that sense of sculpture. But still, you know, it's deteriorating. And I have two stills here from a film, another film called Hollywood Boulevard. Also, I mean, the change from Hollywood Boulevard 1936. To Hollywood Boulevard 1976 is interesting. This is Joe Dante and Alan Arkush film. This is again the denouement happens at the sign. This is one of the characters running to try to save his girlfriend. The graffiti on the sign, you know, you can see the holes where the light bulbs used to be and everything there. And then here is Mary Warrenoff, who is the crazed killer here. And again, you can kind of see the deterioration. Here's one of the telephone poles. Of course, the deterioration of the sign, and you'll be happy to know that she's about to kill the nice young couple, and the wife falls over and squashes her. So that was good. All right, the sign needs help. Look at it. Look at it back there. Oh, there's one O. Go on. It's like a mess. And to the rescue come Hugh Hefner and Alice Cooper. Hugh Hefner and Alice Cooper are the spearheads of a rebuild the sign. There are many rebuild the signs, let's help the sign committees throughout the late 60s and into the 70s, but this is the one that works. And it's intriguing because both Hefner and Alice Cooper are recent LA transplants. You know, they're from the outside. I mean, again, the sign, in a sense, is for people from the outside as well. Certainly not so much from people in the movie business. They start raising money. You can buy a letter for $27,777, and people pony up for that letter. Nobody directly connected to the movie business buys a letter at all. Hefner buys the Y, which you may think is appropriate. The only person, well, the two who was vaguely connected, Andy Williams, the singer, buys a letter, and Gene Autry buys a letter. But Gene Autry, by this time, you know, is an owner of sports teams and big businesses. He's not the singing cowboy star. He doesn't have that same kind of connection to Hollywood that he did in the past there. Most of the other people who buy it are, in fact, businessmen. Here's what it looks like. What it looks like before Reconstruction. Here's some stages of Reconstruction. Helicopter bringing in the steel anchors for the new sign. And here's what it looks like after Reconstruction. That was also from 1978. And pretty much what it looks like now then. Of course, the rebuilding didn't really prevent so much of the modifications that started out with Danny Feingood. Here's another modification. Caltech. apparently they did this with computers. They could figure out what to darken out and what the early computer there. The H is entirely gone. And, you know, it says Perot-wood when Ross Perot runs for president. It says it twice. It says Hollywood when Oliver North testifies at the Iran-Contra thing. It says about 8, 10, 12 different kinds of modifications over the years. But this is there now. We're in the present, and here's one of my favorite views with the James Dean bust at the observatory there. And you know, here's that the flat hillside, the flat top there of Mount Lee. Of course, the Hollywood sign is not on Mount Hollywood; it's on Mount Lee there, and it looks like a mesa, but it's not a mesa. It was flattened by Max Sennett because he was going to build a house there. That could be seen from both the valley and L.A., but he ran out of money. He had his mother supervised it, and they discovered there were a lot of snakes. According to his autobiography, in order to get rid of the snakes because the workmen didn't want to work there, his mother imported 500 feral pigs to eat the snakes. And I don't know if there's any biologists who can tell us whether pigs actually do eat snakes or not, but... what happened to all the pigs then? You think there should be herds of pigs running around Griffith Park, but they're not there. This is the view from the dog park, not usually the view that we get of the sign, because the sign, of course, is canted towards the east, because that's where the buyers were coming from, not towards the west. There's a little close-up view of the sign with the Don Lee, you know, the kind of descendants of Don Lee's towers there, named for Don Lee, the great radio TV pioneer, there who built studios up at the top. And here finally is an image of, it kind of encapsulates to me something of the lure of the sign. People want, the sign gives back to you. The sign has a kind of aura. People want to be photographed. This is again at the observatory. They want to be photographed, and the sign makes your trip to this fantasy land, it anchors it in some way. It gives it a kind of solidity, a kind of reality there. I mean, even though Hollywood is actually number three in production of movies in the world, Bollywood and Nollywood are much bigger there, but it's still, they're Bollywood and Nollywood. You know, they don't have their own names. Hollywood remains that kind of incandescent name that it has accumulated over the years, like some snowball rolling downhill, accumulating significance. Something temporary like this, like the Eiffel Tower for that matter, also supposed to be temporary. A temporary real estate development sign, a billboard that has become to signify so much more. Thank you. Shall we?
Shall we?
Let's
do it. Shall.
Okay.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Love seeing all those old pictures.
Thank
you. That's
great. Oh, thank you.
You must have fun showing those pictures.
Oh, yes.
Talking about the sign. Well, thanks, everybody, for coming. We're going to chat for a little bit, and then we'll open it up to questions. Love to hear all of your thoughts on the Hollywood sign. I learned so much from this book. That was just it was
Thank
great.
You, Kim.
A lot of fun. So you live in Los Feliz. I take it that you've written about, you see the Hollywood sign just about every day of your life.
Oh, it's, yeah.
Kind of like you're Mount Fuji in a way.
Well, exactly. And it reminded me of Hokusai's, you know, views of Mount Fuji that you see from different angles, from different perspectives and things like that all the time.
So did you come to this project with sort of a complicated personal relationship with the sign, or develop it during the process of
well,
learning
I, you
everything
know,
you could
I,
about
I guess what I developed was more the, you know, the surround of the sign. I knew the sign was there, you know, and I had feelings about, sort of inarticulate feelings about it. But I loved the idea of the neighborhood. Part of what I did in working on it, in addition to looking at archives and things like that, was just drive around a lot, go up these streets. I would love, and, you know, with the... check, look, when I saw a weird house of one sort or another that looked old, I'd look it up on Zillow or on the county assessor site to see how old it actually was. I mean, the way, I'd love to see a program that would see how the neighborhoods developed, you know, like what's there in 1915, what's there in 1912.
Peel it back and then see it come forward.
Exactly.
That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Just to kind of see. Well, I mean, it's such an interesting area, Hollywoodland itself.
Right? Mm-hmm. Oh, very.
Yeah. So... this project, the book, is part of a series about American icons that I guess you were brought in, you know, drafted to write.
Well, I knew the series was going on, and I thought this was an icon that needed a book.
Ah, okay.
So I proposed it.
You proposed it.
Yeah.
So how does it, you know, so it's in there amongst other icons, some of them you'd expect, like the Liberty Bell, and others a little less expected, like the hamburger
right.
and Gone with the Wind. Does the Hollywood sign, how does the Hollywood sign fit in that group?
I mean, well, I think it's very anomalous, as I was starting to say at the end there, because it's really something that you can impose more meaning on. I mean, you can impose meaning on the Statue of Liberty or Mount Rushmore or even the hamburger. But it's very plastic. It's very malleable there. Everybody has its his or her own meaning for Hollywood, and that's what the sign somehow embodies. It's like the intersection of all those different meanings.
Is that something you can do because it's just words? It's just a word, it's just letters?
Just because it's a word, yeah. I mean, you know, and it doesn't date. I think that's what's interesting about it, too. I mean, you know, you look at the Statue of Liberty again, you look at some of these other icons, and, you know, and they have a resonance, they have an aura to them, but you know this is 19th century or this is 18th century there. But a word like this and that kind of blocky letters there, it doesn't date in the same way. It seems entirely always simultaneous, always contemporary.
You write in the book that not only did they want it to be seen from Wilshire Boulevard or from across the city, but it also was written in kind of a more modern font for what Los Angeles
was
seeing in those days.
Right. It was a font that, I mean, to the extent that, I mean, first of all, it's very, you couldn't make it in script letters anyhow. I mean, there's, you know, there's a kind of mechanical reason why it looks that way. But it was a font that was actually starting to be used then. It was called mechanical. And you know, that kind of square, blocky, sans serif look to it was definitely on the cutting edge.
And so you talk about that time. So the sign is built in 1923 with the housing development, a time when there was a lot of building going on in Los Angeles. Now, wasn't that the peak year for building permits in the
yeah,
boom of the 20s?
Yeah, the peak year, more building permits were issued that year than ever before or since.
And so things were just going crazy around town in terms of construction. So
well, I mean, all sorts of things were going on. The Olmsted brothers, you know, the sons of Frederick Law Olmsted, who did Central Park, were off in the Palos Verdes Peninsula building. People were in Catalina built. I mean, they're all over the place. In the 1920s, these kind of things were happening. And I was reading somebody's letters that somebody had collected them of had come from the Midwest. For a visit and sent these letters back to the home folks about what was happening. And it was all about driving around, going around, seeing all these developments. And the people who wrote them finally came and settled here.
And I was also struck by how, as you said, at the time it was built, the filmland part of Hollywood had nothing to do with it, probably didn't even know what was going on, didn't necessarily want anything to do with it.
Yeah, didn't really care. And they were living, there's these... just again, I was thinking about that time in the 20s. I mentioned in the book that Ernst Lubitsch, the German director, was being hired by Mary Pickford to direct a film. And he was interviewed in the paper, and he said, "I'm going to Hollywood." So it's already, that's what it means. Same time, like a couple weeks later, there's an interview with Douglas Fairbanks. And he says, oh, we don't live in Hollywood. we live in Beverly Hills. So, I mean, it's just really remarkable to me, you know, how something like, it's almost as if it's necessary that people need to have one word to talk about this incredibly complicated and self-contradictory world.
Well, and did it serve that role in the context of those scandals that you singled out? The Fatty Arbuckle scandal, the William Desmond Taylor murder near downtown. There was even the Thomas Ince being taken off Hearst's boat. With about a 2-year period,
There
was a real run of bad publicity for Hollywood, or whatever you're going to call it. And all the reports did call it Hollywood, and that sort of helped spread the concept of Hollywood.
Yeah, and that's that negative side. I mean, there's the scandal, there's the boosterist side, and then there's the scandal side, and they sort of go along together and interweave almost.
So there's a lot of interesting characters in the book, and some of them you've mentioned already, Wilcox and Toberman, certainly, and Harry Chandler's overlap. So it sounds like, in that period in the 20s when people are just getting onto the concept of Hollywood, that Samuel Goldwyn is starting to use the term, and Sid Grauman is building the Egyptian, and then the Chinese. Were those important developments at the time? This concept of Hollywood out in the larger world?
Well, Goldwyn is interesting because, I mean, his use, because he writes a book in the 20s, mid-20s, sort of about the stars that he brought out, and kind of self-promoting book, and he uses the word, Hollywood, to talk about studios in Long Beach, Hollywood is sort of cut off from its geographic roots entirely, by this point already there. Yeah, and Toberman is such an important figure in the kind of commercial development of Hollywood, and he and Grauman get together there, and, it's really exhibition and promotion. That's what he's interested in, but he doesn't want the noise and the smell and the problems of studios or even actors around for that much.
And then comes 1939, and Hollywood Land as a housing development has sort of played out. They stop maintaining the sign, but it's a really interesting time in and around, in Los Angeles and in Hollywood in particular. You've got, the writers out here, Nathaniel West and Fitzgerald working at studios. Wizard of Oz is being made. Gone with the Wind is coming out that year.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. 1939, I'm sure many of you know, is always considered to be this is the fantastic prime year of Hollywood. But it's also the year when the Hollywood sign sort of turns off its lights, too. The book tries to get into this history filled with paradoxes of this sort. Paradoxes of, I suppose in general, on the one hand, promotion, reaching for the stars, reaching for, for some kind of transcendence at the same time that you're going down the tubes in other ways.
It's so much interweaving, in the book with the Hollywood sign, the rise of Hollywood, and L.A.'s history more generally, and America's history. And what was it, 40, in the late 40s, when the Rec and Parks Commission is talking about tearing down the sign and thinking it's just a relic that has to go. Then HUAC comes out and starts investigating Hollywood at the same time.
Right. I mean, Hollywood is, HUAC is the kind of descendant of the, all the finger-wagging people in the pulpits and the women's clubs in the 20s who said it's, instead of being the site of kind of sexual sins and things like that, it's the site of political sins. Mm. So they come, so there's kind of these sort of, eternal returns, deja vu all over again kinds of things about the attitude towards Hollywood. Of course, Hollywood is still a kind of whipping boy for a lot of people, a lot of politicians these days as well.
And it's about that time in the 40s when the Hollywood sign starts to build a little bit more of a constituency, right? If for no other thing than the opening of the Hollywood Freeway, right? Which brings a lot of people by to just see the sign.
Right, and you have great views of it, sure. Mm-hmm.
It also ties into the way the sign is really, a creature, a relic of L.A.'s car culture? I mean, is it a reflection
very
of
much,
car culture?
Very much about car culture, very much about drive. I mean, all the big signs, all the kind of, ostentatious architecture. I mean, the tail of the pup, the big donuts, the guy with the axe who has many different functions depending on where he is. This all, you need to grab people's attention when you're driving around. There, it's very much about car culture in that way.
And you had to drive even to go to Hollywood Land.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even though it had the stairways and all that, you weren't really.
The stairways are sort of vestigial almost. I mean, if you go the stairways, let's say in Silver Lake or in Echo Park, there are stairways made for people who are taking public transportation. Mm-hmm. You know, you get out of your red car and you walk up your stairway to your street there. And there are stairways in Hollywoodland, but it's, you know, they're more for scenic.
Yeah, you're not walking down them to catch the bus.
No.
Even though the buses in those days were all the open-air double-decker buses, and you probably could see the Hollywood sign mm-hmm. as you were cruising around on those buses.
Well, they had a special bus at the corner of Franklin and Beechwood that could drive people up there, too, you know, who were looking for property.
In the sense that the Hollywood sign essentially is a billboard, a giant billboard, and it, you know, to that sense, it fits in this longer conversation that Los Angeles has been having internally for more than 100 years about billboards. You even mentioned in your book going back to Gaylord Wilshire's day. He was, among other things, among being a developer and a socialist and a congressional political candidate, he was one of the early billboard moguls and one of the first people to be called into court as a billboard nuisance.
Right. And he was very much in favor of billboards, and the Los Angeles Times was very much against billboards. So they used to refer to him as Bughouse Wilshire when he was talked about in the papers. They thought they were after it. This was the City Beautiful. The City Beautiful should not have billboards. Of course, it's a controversy that we still have right now.
Well, that's what I wanted to kind of get to. So how do you know, we're still talking about billboards today. We're debating the question of super graphics on buildings and whether or not to have lighting districts downtown that would actually promote really bold, well-lit billboards. And we spent the city attorneys out there arresting people who are putting up illegal billboards all over town. It's kind of a continuation of the same debate. What do you make of that?
I think it's still very much part of the car culture. I mean, again, the need to grab people's attention. You know, L.A. was the first neon in America was in L.A. Mm-hmm. It was in a car dealership downtown. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, the advertising ways of, you know, the advertising can grab people's attention was very much on the mind of merchants and commercial people in Los Angeles. Of course, now we're at this business about whether we should have digital signs on the sides of buses.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming up now, too.
People fight about whether or not to have advertising, you know, on the trash barrels on the beach, things like that. It's just a hot-button issue in Los Angeles and just always has been.
Well, in part it's because of which connects to the car culture, it's part of the diffuseness of Los Angeles. I mean, we're all so spread out there that if somebody wants to make a name for themselves, you know, for their business, they have to do this. Before I moved here, I thought that, you know, and when I first would come around, I thought that L.A. was a place where you could be driving along in a neighborhood that you've never been in before, and you'd see a cheese shop, and it would probably be the best cheese shop in L.A., just because there are no nodal place or very few nodal places that way. You don't go to a certain place and know that all the kind of stores you want to are there. Although I think what's happened in the 25, you know, almost 30 years that I've been here is that because it's so difficult to get around town, that the neighborhoods are starting to develop in a different way there too, and people staying in neighborhoods and neighborhoods being sort of all functioning in a way that they really weren't before.
Well, you've given me an opening then to ask about this past weekend in Los Angeles when the freeway was going to close and everybody was going a little crazy thinking about it. You have any thoughts about Carmageddon?
Well, I think inside of every car driving Los Angelino is somebody who wants to stay home.
That's interesting.
And, you know, and it's that and if you're given enough opportunity and enough reason and you're being civic-minded if you do it, people love to stay home. They want to stay in their backyard. The same thing happened with the Olympics. You know, and now everybody's they're kind of gloomsayers are saying, oh, well, the second time this happens, people aren't going to respond the same way because they know it's going to work. I don't think that's true. I think people will jump at the opportunity. Now, the other sort of imagistic side of it is that everybody loves to see creepy, empty places. I don't know if anybody remember The World, the Flesh, and the Devil, that movie from the 50s, Harry Belafonte, exactly. You know, three people left alone in empty New York. I mean, it's like this kind of apocalyptic. Mm. I mean, it's a different kind. It's not Blade Runner apocalypse, which is apocalypse with a lot of junky things in it. It's emptiness apocalypse. So I think there's a kind of hankering for that as well.
It's not quite creepy emptiness, but people are, it seems like the sort of city enthusiasts and bloggers have rediscovered Hollywoodland as a place to go on walking tours on weekends and lead groups around and kind of gawk at the architecture and some of the signs that are built in there. Is that a surprise to you?
It's not a surprise. I think, actually, my wife and I belong to a very small group. It's about 8 friends. And, you know, every couple months we pick a different neighborhood to go walk around in. We do a little research. And I think it's connected to the sign, or at least the history of the sign, rather. Because another thing that happens in the late 1970s is that the Los Angeles Conservancy is founded. And so this, you know, you can date the kind of reconstruction of the sign and the founding of the Conservancy and as a kind of coming to self-consciousness about Los Angeles history that really wasn't there. I mean, of course, there were very individuals who had it, but wasn't there in a kind of civic way in the same way. The real predecessor for it, and I think the kind of what lays the groundwork for the interest in the sign are two things. One is Watts Towers, the fight to save Watts Towers, and the other is the upset of the destruction of the Brown Derby there, the Wilshire Brown Derby there. But it's interesting with Watts Towers that the Parks and Recreation Department are, again, the villain in this. They think it's all totally unstable. They want to tear it down. They tie this, you know, this 10,000-pound weight to the top of the towers, and towers don't budge at all. So,
In fact, the Watts Towers discussion was a much bigger civic debate than saving the Hollywood sign, wasn't it?
Much bigger. But I think it's there. It sort of lays the groundwork. It's part of the context. And I've noticed in kind of going through the newspapers, especially in the Times, that after the whole Watts Towers thing, you start getting articles about 10 things to see in L.A., things like that, you know, that. The consciousness, from all parts of L.A. history, you know, from the Mission period and before onward, Californio period onward, you know, let's go to this Pueblo, let's go to this Mission, let's go to this building, let's go to the Bradbury building. So you get these kinds of lists, and it's part of that sense that you live in a place that has a history that you should cherish and you should pay attention to.
Why has there been such an ambivalence, though, about the Hollywood sign? I mean, it didn't get its historic cultural monument status until, 5 years after the Hollywoodland gates got status, or landmark status.
It's always been a latecomer in that way. And it's, you know, part of, and the sign, it, and maybe because it's considered to be too popular culture. You know, sort of like the faults of its virtues in a certain way, but the sign, you know, so many things got that kind of status, that kind of long before the sign did.
Do you feel that now it has won its place permanently in the hearts of Los Angeles as an icon?
Well, I think it's clearer that it's won a place in the hearts of the world more than it's won a place in the hearts of Los Angeles. I mean, I can't take a walk in Griffith Park without, somebody coming up in, with a foreign accent saying, is this the way to the Hollywood sign or the equivalent there? I mean, it draws.
That's because they've already been sent astray by people in Beechwood Canyon who are telling them it's over in Glendale, right?
So. They're telling They don't want that. Well, you were mentioning that before about the hikes. I mean, the other side of the hikes is that the inhabitants of Hollywoodland are very upset.
Exactly.
Somebody put up some signs saying this way to the Hollywood sign. Oh, I think it was actually the Hollywoodland, one of the local town councils, and they were immediately chopped down by various local residents. I mean, you know, it's a narrow place. One of the where everybody I think who was around was disappointed with the Y2K celebration. It seemed so feeble. But part of the reason was the fire department. You know, they didn't want it illuminated there, and also the inhabitants of that area. They didn't want the sign illuminated because if something would happen there, how could the fire engines get up those hills? It's very dangerous. In that way. Now, this, of course, has a long history. While they were renovating the sign, rather, in the 70s, people, because all the trucks going by, there would be residents up there with signs saying, death to the sign, too. I think, it's that another kind of ambivalence, another kind of paradox to every Huxley image of the sign in the background. Everybody who's, you meet anybody who lives in Beechwood, and they say, "Oh, I live right under the sign," right? And who knows, they probably do. I mean, everybody lives right under the sign there. But then there's this, but I don't want you coming up. Or I don't want these roads crammed with people looking for the sign.
Before we open it up to questions, yeah. I mean, and maybe this could spur some questions from the audience, what do you think it says about Los Angeles that this has become such a strong icon for us? I mean, is it filling a vacuum in our longer narrative? I mean, is it just there's nothing else that's gonna stand?
Well, it's the process by which it became this big, Hollywood itself as a word, mm-hmm. became a term for an industry that is very disparate, that's all over the place, that has many different kinds of people, that lives in many different places. I forgot to mention, I should mention just parenthetically here, that in the late 1930s, there was an activist group in Culver City that wanted to change the name of Culver City to Hollywood. And their reasoning was more movies were made in Culver City than were made in Hollywood. Who's from Culver City?
These days, I guess Burbank could do that if it wanted.
Burbank could do it, sure. And Warner's in Burbank and Disney, and I mean, it's just. Mm. And it's always been around Hollywood, but somehow Hollywood, in the course, the word Hollywood and the sign that anchors that word in the course of years became this shorthand, became this kind of synecdoche for talking about a lot of very different and complicated things.
But for a lot of people, it's synonymous with Los Angeles as well.
Well, I think the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce is a little upset at that, because it's hard. I don't know if it's a conspiracy or not, but there's a very concerted effort there was over the last several years to make Disney Hall into the symbol of Los Angeles, or to make the cathedral and Disney Hall, that is to bring the focus, the symbolic focus, downtown again, and. That also goes back to the beginnings as I was sketching them out there, that kind of conflict between Los Angeles and Hollywood, and of course was replicated again with the Hollywood secession movement not too many years back, which failed, but, it was an assertion there. We are different. And in fact, the state legislature sort of gave them a sop of that the records of the city of Hollywood are kept separately as if Hollywood was a separate city rather than being part of Los Angeles.
Well, before we do open it up to questions, we'll ask you one more thing. What is Ordinance 78,499?
Now, which one is that?
This is the one that declared the boundaries of Hollywood much huger than we think of it today.
Yeah. No, that stretched the boundary of Hollywood out to the river.
All the way to the river.
Enormous. Yeah. I mean, there are all these efforts. What is Hollywood? I showed you that plat map. Hollywood expanded a bit by annexation. That Hollywood just went up to Sunset. Then Hollywood swallowed up the area south. It was called South Hollywood. It was actually called Colgrove, this town there. It was founded by Senator Cornelius Cole, who was the senator from California. It was the longest-lived American senator, still lived to be 101. Founded this town called Colgrove, named it after his wife. His wife's maiden name was Colgrove. But it was swallowed up. It was a competitor with Hollywood for a while. So it took Hollywood down to Santa Monica, and it gradually kind of grew in that what Hollywood meant. But that ordinance that you mentioned there tried to make it as enormous as possible. And these are still things that intrigue me. I mean, say, why is it that, why does Franklin get wider at certain places and close down at other places? A lot of these things are the remnants of these earlier efforts to decide where the boundaries were.
That's very interesting. I wonder whether that ordinance is still in effect. What do you see as the future of the Hollywood sign? I mean, do you see its status elevating to the point that at some point we, to placate the neighbors, we have a municipal-supported viewing area somewhere where people, all the tour buses would go and get them off the streets, and maybe we shine lights up at the sign from way down below?
I hope not. I mean, I think it's part of the mystique, part of the genius of the sign to be almost inaccessible. I mean, it's like Hollywood fame itself. It's on this high hill. You have to really climb to get it. You have to kind of wear yourself out. I mean, certain things should not be easy to get to.
Well, and this is not. Have you been up there?
Oh, yeah.
And isn't it one of essentially the, not only real steep, and it's treacherous to get there. But now, is it one of the most high security outdoor locations in Los Angeles?
It's very high security. It has motion sensors. It has TV cameras. It has sound sensors. It was declared a soft target by the security administration, the anti-terrorist people. A soft target meaning that no one would get killed if it were destroyed, but everybody would be really upset.
I think there's a third category there, though, who wouldn't necessarily care.
But, I mean, even so, when I was up there last, I mean, it has all this stuff and all these sensors and things like that, and there's a gate there. I mean, I went up with the head of the Hollywood Sign Trust so I could get in. But, you know, somebody had already dug underneath the gate and gotten down in there.
So. Well, this evening is being recorded and will be available as a podcast, and so they have a microphone that they'd like to bring around to you if you want to answer a question. And she has the microphone.
My question was about the growth of residences into the hills. The first ones that you showed us were in the flats, those castles.
Right.
And then it gradually went into the hills, and obviously this is all about growth into the hills. And I just wondered, was it the advent of the car that made it possible, or was it that land was running out and people could get more land in the hills? Because my understanding was that it wasn't always such a great thing to live in the hills, and it's only now that we think of it as the glamorous place that it is.
Oh, no, it was considered glamorous as in that, or at least it was promoted as glamorous, as in that advertisement that I showed you. But you're right, it's about the car. It's about, you know, something fancier than living on the flats and something more exclusive than living on the flats. It's a combination of car accessibility and also engineering techniques, kind of laying it out. In fact, the techniques that were used to build the roads and the utilities and things like that to lay out Hollywood Land were considered to be very innovative enough that a lot of Swiss came over, you know, to see how to build on hillsides and things like that, so they could do the same back in Switzerland. So it was definitely on the cutting edge.
And the 1920s was also the decade when we saw the beginning of the linear downtowns like Wilshire Boulevard, the distant downtowns, and also the beginning of the decline in ridership on the red cars. Started as early as the 20s. People switched to the car.
Hi, thank you. Well, I was born and raised right here in Los Angeles. I even graduated from Hollywood High School. So I'm a real Los Angelino, okay?
Thank you.
And I happen to work as a tour guide. And believe me, I can verify that every tourist that comes to this city wants to see the Hollywood sign. It's just up there on their list, okay? And they get so excited to see it and everything. But my question is that I've heard so many conflicting numbers, and I figure that you would probably know.
I hope.
Okay. What is the height of the letters?
Ah, okay. Interesting question. All the sources, and I say this in the book, and when you go, and I hope buy a book, you can go and correct this in the book. All the sources say 50 feet. I spoke to those two color photos of one of the old deteriorating sign and the one of the rebuilt sign were given to me by Raiden Peterson, who was the head of construction, reconstruction for the new sign. He said they traced the letters, everything exactly, and they're 45 feet high. Yeah, 45. And so the 50, you know, it was sort of like one of these received stories, little, you know, let's exaggerate, another Hollywood story, let's exaggerate it, give it another 5 feet. It probably started out saying almost 50 feet high, and then it became 50 feet. Sure.
Thank you, first of all, for writing this book. As a Chicago native, I find it very interesting that the origin of this sign has Chicago roots. And then with the deterioration of the sign, you know, someone from Chicago kind of came to the rescue. My question is, what contributed to the shift of the Hollywood sign being something temporary to being something worth fighting for?
Well, I think it's a good question. I think it's really, I would date it to that time in 1949 when they take the land off of it. And so then it becomes Hollywood. It's a word there. But it takes a while. It's gradual. From 49, let's say, to, 61, it's sort of, they don't really do anything about it. Finally, by 61, they hire somebody to patch it up. And then, as I mentioned, there's a series of patches over the years. So it's a slow development. It's a slow penetration into people's consciousness that it's really something to think about. Of course, with this, the most recent situation, and here's another Chicago part to it, of course. This is the evil Chicago part. Howard Hughes owned land behind the sign. And he bought this land so he could build a love nest for himself and Ginger Rogers. But Ginger Rogers dumped him because he was, had too many girlfriends on the side. But Howard Hughes got all the variances necessary for the utilities and for access roads and things like that there. So that's in the early 40s. Let's jump then to the early 21st century. The Hughes estate wants to get rid of various pieces of property for whatever reason. They sell it to a Chicago firm for something just under $2 million. The Chicago firm then puts it on the market for $20 million and says they're going to build luxury housing behind the Hollywood sign. Everybody flips out, right? Tom LaBange, the councilman, says, "Why? That the city dropped the ball originally, not buying that land." So there's another frenzy. The Trust for Public Land, a nonprofit, comes in and negotiates the price down to $12 million. And then there's a campaign, which I'm sure many of you know about, a campaign to raise that $12 million there, to buy that land so there won't be a house sitting on top of the H or something like that. This time, more Hollywood people contribute, much more than before. Studios contribute, individuals, Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg, people like that contribute. It's enough generations have gone by that they feel the same way, but they're newcomers in a certain sense as well. They're not the old Hollywood, the old Hollywood group. And so they have up to 11 million. They need another million times, getting close. And so who comes riding into the rescue with the last million but Hugh Hefner? Again, so everything goes around, comes around.
Okay.
Yes. Hi. Just a quick question. The sign got more deteriorated after, I guess, the studio era kind of fell apart. And at the same time, I'm from the city myself, and what Hollywood is now isn't what it was even 20 years ago. And I remember when Hollywood Boulevard was pornography shops and army surplus stores. Did the deterioration of the sign or anything lead to something like that, or was it other factors? Or
well, I don't think I don't think there's any causality, but there's certainly a kind of community there, certainly an association there. The deterioration of Hollywood, the deterioration of the sign. 1960, of course, the Chamber of Commerce tries to stop this with the Hollywood Walk of Fame there too. Again, to kind of spruce up the image of Hollywood. The community, people blame the community redevelopment, for tearing down a lot of the old buildings rather than renovating them. It's a whole complicated story, but the kind of broad outlines of the story is that, as you say, it is a kind of general deterioration, and now it's finally coming back, although still a lot of those funky places are there.
Do you think that the renaissance of Hollywood itself has contributed to Filmland embracing the sign finally?
Well, I think that the renaissance of Hollywood is really much more for the tourists. I think it's really a generational thing. The people, again, like Hanks or Spielberg or people like that, you're a couple three generations at least,
so
down from
the
Louis Mayer and people like that who could care less about the Hollywood sign. I mean, these are people who themselves, kind of came here to make it in that way, for whom the sign was symbolic.
So it's an important icon for them.
Yeah.
I wonder if you would just comment on what's going on with the plans for the Capitol Records building, and if there are any other buildings, whether it's the theme building at LAX or Randy's Donuts or any other buildings that have or are close to achieving iconic stature in the history of Los Angeles?
Well, I think there are a lot of those kinds of buildings around, and I think what's happened in the past 30 years or so is that there's a consciousness that those buildings should be saved. I mean, if you belong to the Conservancy or read about the Conservancy, you know that every issue of their newsletter is about Bob's Big Boy or some place that needs to be preserved, that shouldn't be plowed under there. I mean, it's just the changes in Hollywood and the changes in any city had happened so quickly, and the sense that this was a place without a past originally. It was just sagebrush and chaparral, and you could come out there like the Wilcoxes and build what you wanted there. That was great. But what's sort of the negative side of that is that you can knock down whatever you want to and put something new in its place. And certain things maybe, there are questions about the preservation quality of certain things. But I think, any place, you lose the place's soul when you lose its past, when you lose some of its great buildings in that way.
That's so nicely said. Well, we hope that you will consider a membership in the library and support the Aloud program. And thank you all for coming, and thank you, Professor Brody.
Thank you, Kevin.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.